Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. On today's episode, we are celebrating a brand new documentary special that is live now on SOM TV about the Santa Margarita family, the Marzotto family that is behind all of the wines that you have seen and drank probably many times. Very big company, but with a very, very intimate story. I'm very excited about this. It's a great documentary. We filmed it in Venice, Italy, which is one of my favorite cities in the world. And you can watch that now streaming on SOM TV. To celebrate, I'm going to be speaking with Luca Marzotto, who is a fourth generation of this family that not only makes wine, but they've been involved in fashion, glass, and all sorts of other things, including dairy. Their family goes back generations in Italy in so many different commodities. It is really fascinating. I have a very candid conversation with him at his house in Venice, and I hope you enjoy that. I do want to remind everybody that Cup of Salvation is about to open in New York City on the 7th of December, and tickets are selling out very fast. You can get your tickets at somfilms.com. We're also opening in Boston on the 5th and 6th of December as well. This is a very, very big film and a very big month for this film, so I would grab your tickets before they sell out. Without further ado, my conversation with Luca Marzotto of the Marzotto family. Luca, it's good to talk to you. I appreciate your time here. I want to start with introducing who you are. How do you introduce yourself?
I am an entrepreneur in different fields, Italian, and very linked to tradition and Venetian.
As an entrepreneur, what do you mean?
That I have a high perception of risk, or a low perception of risk. I like to risk.
Yeah, that sounds like you have a dangerous personality.
Yeah, dangerous personality.
I like that.
I don't like safe things.
You don't like safe things, but okay. So what do you do for your job?
We produce wine. Mm-hmm. We do some packaging, glass packaging. We are in the fashion industry. We come from textile as a family, and we are in the fashion industry as well.
It's interesting because we're on the Grand Canal in Venice. Is this your dining room? What would you call this?
No, this is the entrance.
Oh, this is just the entrance.
Yeah.
Okay. And thinking about being in Venice, being in a house like this, and being from a family, did you grow up like this?
No, I wasn't. I didn't grow up in Venice.
Uh-huh.
No. I was born in Rome. Different environment. But, you know. You mean as an environment?
Yeah, this kind of...
No, I bought this house. I didn't inherit this house. I chose the house, I bought it myself. I was not born here.
Let me ask you, since you do live in Venice, and you know, I should mention that you're the CEO of Caldamasco,
yeah.
The Franciacorta.
Yeah.
You come from a family that works with Santa Margarita wines.
Yes.
You make glass. I mean,
yes.
The glass bottles that you make are very, maybe. Very, they're everywhere. They are all
throughout. Yeah, in Italy, yes.
In Italy, at least, yeah. I was at dinner the other night, and I think I was with you, and there was a bottle on the table. It was olive oil, and you said, hey, we make this bottle.
Yeah, we do that. We do also olive oil.
So what did your family started in going back, generations?
Yeah, my grand-grandfather started from textile. We come from wool, yarn, fabrics, and this all other activities, wine and glass packaging, came just after the First World War, because he wanted to differentiate the activity. And so he bought this land in the countryside, and he had the idea to bring all the products of the land directly to the market. It was also an entrepreneur, he was looking forward to what things could have happened. So Zignago, which is the company I run, in fact, at that time, used to make 30 products, from fruit juice to everything related to agriculture, milk, yogurt, everything related to cows and to land. So linen yarn, cotton yarn, 28 products, soaps, powder. It was a disaster. He lost really a lot of money. So my father and my uncles, they tried to, you know, make his entrepreneurial idea work. And so at the end, they focused on three activities, which was the milk and cheese and yogurt production, the wine business, and the packaging. But it all comes from wool.
All from wool. So why at that time period? Why at the end of World War One, and why leave textiles? Why not just go bigger on textiles? What's the reason to
do it? Because we were actually very big in textiles.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and then because just after the war, people from the countryside didn't have any work. So they used to work for 4 months a year, and then the rest of the year they wouldn't do anything, and they were struggling to survive. So my grandfather thought, let's give them an activity also the rest of the year. So we make of the agricultural problem an industry. He was an entrepreneur, you know, looking forward.
And did he start, just this is so fascinating to me, did he start companies or buy companies? And then?
No, he did start everything by himself.
Okay.
Yeah. But it was obviously it was a different moment in history where things, you know, after the Second World War, Italy was in a moment that everything must, we needed everything.
Yeah.
So work and all other products. So this is why he was...
trying to diversify.
Not only, but try to help the country to... There was a great demand and a moment of reconstruction. So he chose this sector.
Yeah.
And well, wine especially, because he was a good drinker. He loved wine. And he had specific ideas on wine, how to make wine. And he wanted to brought a concept of marketing that he had, because we were active in textile and apparel, into the wine industry as well.
You know, I think about multi-generational successful families, and I know there are lots of ups and downs, and it can be very scary and very hard to hang on.
Yeah.
What happened during World War II? Because I'm going to get to, I think people know Santa Margherita very well, especially in the United States.
Yeah, but it was not existing.
Of course not, but we're going to get there. And that is something that I find endlessly fascinating. You see a bottle, you see a lot of it, you think, you know, whatever you think, it doesn't matter. But we'll get to the Pinot Grigio or all that stuff. But my question is, how did your grandfather and your great-grandfather, how did they survive World War II and keep the business intact?
That's a good question. I was not there at that time. From what I know from the history, we had many years of where the activity was frozen, and where, in fact, nothing was done and everything was frozen. So when war ended, the company started to work again. And so this is how it restarted. But during the war period, just few activity were able to continue.
Just hanging on, basically.
Yes.
Yeah. For Americans, for I think most of the world now, Prosecco, and I know that you are not, you know, you're not the head of Santa Margherita or any of this, but you're part of the family and you are doing, you're involved. Prosecco is a very, very, everyone knows it. And I don't know that I've ever seen a wine outside of maybe Malbec be a name people were not familiar with and then become something everyone knows so fast. Yeah. Wine takes a long time. It took Bordeaux 250 years to be Bordeaux. So probably longer, honestly. So how did somebody, your great-grandfather, right? Or was it your grandfather? How did they have the idea?
But at that time, Prosecco was, Glera was, which is the grape of Prosecco, was vinified, was not a sparkling wine. They tried to make it sparkling. Prosecco is a simple, Glera is a simple grape, fresh, very fruit forward, and easy to drink. It was the perfect product that was could be a sparkling wine, easy to drink for everyday consumption.
And for everybody.
For everybody.
Yeah.
It was very democratic.
So when now that you look at it and you run a company, you run Cato Bosco, which is very important in Francia Corta, a pioneer there. So when you look at this, do you wonder why he didn't do the traditional method? Why did he, you know?
Prosecco has a simpler occasion of consumption, while Franciacorta is taking inspiration from Méthode Champenoise, from Champagne. It's a much smaller area, and it is meant to be a limited and exclusive product. Prosecco is more democratic. It was a day-by-day consumption, used for everything. They say that a bust of success of Prosecco was the fact that it was used in cocktails, in spritz, no?
Cocktails.
Yeah. And also is a great name, is easy to say, is cool, and so you don't know why things happen, and Prosecco's success was incredible.
Well, I think
in the last 15, 20 years, Prosecco was a typical Italian, not even Italian, it was a northeast of Italy consumption product.
Could you imagine Champagne or Franciacorta or any traditional method embracing, mixing their drink with something else?
No.
I mean, it...
No. No, it's a different story. It is a different method, has different costs. They are not... they are cocktails that where they use also champagne.
Oh, of course, absolutely.
But Prosecco was a very straightforward, simple, and democratic appetizer or drink. In the very area, you go to a bar, you ask, 6, 7 o'clock in the evening for an appetizer. You go there for a Prosecco, it's a very... You don't have to think about it. It's just...
Yeah. Simple choice.
Simple choice.
Yeah. I will tell you, so the amount of spritzes I've had on this trip and the love I've fallen in with them has been pretty stupendous.
Yeah.
I may be instituting a spritz hour at my house at about 3 p.m. every day from now on.
3 p.m.?
Maybe early, maybe 11. What time's the right time to have a spritz?
It depends, before lunch or before dinner?
Or both. Right, okay. So being in Venice, one of the things that really fascinates me is you're Venetian, you're here.
Yeah.
And people come to Venice and they're tourists, and depends on how you see Venice. I happen to be lucky to see Venice from a very different perspective. A lot of times I get to be with people like you. But for most people, it's hot, you're surrounded by tourists, you're trying very hard to figure out where to go. What is it like to live in Venice, to actually live here, to raise children? You have three boys, you've got a family here.
But we are very fortunate because Venice has great infrastructure for schools, and not all of Venice is so crowded. There are parts of Venice where still there is a space for services for inhabitants. It is true that population of Venice has been declining in the last 10, 20 years. But still, it's an unbelievable place where you see culture, you see beauty all around yourself. There is a very high quality of life. And if you're not, if you can find, it's like a little village, everybody knows each other. So besides the fact that there is a lot of tourism, you can still have a wonderful life.
Hmm. What's the wine culture like here?
You mean in terms of consumption or production?
Consumption, I think, is more interesting. I mean, from a consumption standpoint, with people who live here in Venice, talk to me about wine in Venice a little bit, because it's obviously why I'm here.
But here, it's in wine. It's a typical, and everybody has the attitude to go out and have aperitivo in the afternoon before dinner. And sometimes aperitivo goes on till dinner, and you don't even have dinner because you go on with the aperitivo. So it's the culture here to go and have we call an ombra de vin before dinner, and to speak with people and to know each other and to spend time in these little baccaros that they give you little things to eat. And at the end of the day, you don't even go out for dinner. So you have dinner there, and so the relationship with wine is natural. Venetians, they don't drink a lot of super alcoholics. They will basically go for red wine, white wine, or mainly Prosecco.
Yeah, the fact that you can just have wine casually in your life, and it doesn't have to be anything different than food, is Americans just can't seem to get this right. I don't know how long it's going to take us to realize that wine is not this dangerous grenade. You know, it's like, it's just part of the table. I don't really understand why we can't get this right. But anyways, back to Prosecco and back to sparkling wine. What do you think is the future? Because right now is an interesting moment for Prosecco. Prosecco is everywhere. There's very high levels of Prosecco. There's very approachable levels of Prosecco.
Consumption of sparkling wine has been growing, generally speaking, not only Prosecco. Prosecco within this category has been doing very well, much better than others. Sparkling wines coming from other countries, like, for example, in Spain, Cava, or I'm not talking about Champagne because that's a different market segment. Prosecco is a great product that is known everywhere. As you were saying, it's successful in Germany, in England, in the United States, in all the world, everybody knows Prosecco now. So if we will be able to keep the quality high and as an industry and to be very disciplined in our way of being, it will be successful. It will continue to be successful.
Just out of curiosity, what percentage of, I don't really mean your business, but just your amount of production, is Pinot Grigio versus Prosecco versus...
No, we're not a big Prosecco producer. In terms of percentage of the group, Prosecco will be maybe 12% of our turnover.
And what's the biggest? Is it Pinot Grigio? Is probably the biggest?
The biggest is Pinot Grigio.
And that's all coming, all Alto Adige?
It's coming from Alto Adige. Going back to my grandfather, he was a great lover of white wines. But at that time, white wine was an issue. It was difficult to find. He was very sensible to sulfites, very sensible. So he couldn't have white wine easily. He would have been suffering by big time by headaches. So he gave a mandate to his enologists to find the best white wine coming from our territory with the lowest possible use of sulfites. We're talking about the end of the 50s. And so the enologists went up in Alto Adige, where the vineyards are average 700-800 meters high. The climate change was not there at that time, so temperature was low. And so the production of this white wine was possible without any sulfides added.
And that was it. That's it? That's the story?
And the story was that we put this product in the market with the name of because Santa Margherita was my, his wife, that she was dead. She died some years before, Margherita. And he invented the name Santa Margherita. He put it on the market, and because to have a white wine which was good and clearly with low content of sulfites, so safe, there were not many products in the market at that time. So it was a market leader.
It's incredible because it's such a, I would say it's the most easily found wine. At least where I live in California, if I was to go to any store, I know I can find it, which is a whole other podcast on how you guys pulled that off. I really don't understand. It's an incredible thing to have a product, have a lot of a product, and also be able to put that product in the marketplace, something I've never figured out myself. But it's incredible that the story is that simple.
Yeah, very simple. But I try to make it short. Yeah. But it is simple. And that is the success story. And the success story is to be that we have maintained coherency on this. So the recipe of Pinot Grigio is exactly the same that what it was. Our source is exactly the same that was in the 50s, in the 60s. We have been in partnership with families that give us grapes for...
Since the 50s?
Yeah.
It's incredible. It really is. Alto Adige is one of the most beautiful places I've ever been.
Yeah.
I mean, it truly is.
And you know, their property of vineyards is very small. So sometimes someone has 1 hectare, 2 hectares. So you really have relation with a lot of families.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very fascinating. So what do you see as the future for your family? Just keep doing what you're doing? Are you going to get into gin at some point, or get into...
No. We will be coherent and we will stay into wine. Now we have a big dream to be more important in the United States. As you know, we want to enlarge our presence in Oregon. And regarding Italy, we are one of the possible companies that can aggregate other players in other regions. We are not in a hurry. We are very selective in the regions we work with. We like to be a niche. We don't want to be in regions where you cannot be qualified by quality and exclusiveness of the product. And so this is we're not in a hurry to grow.
Where else in the United States besides Oregon? What's your dream places that you would want to work in?
No, we will focus in Oregon.
Oregon's the one.
Yeah.
Nothing.
We think Oregon is a great place.
Yeah. Well, Oregon is a great place. That makes sense. Okay. This is great. You have anything else you want to ask me?
No.
No?
No, if you had fun.
Of course I had fun. Venice, Venice is one of my favorite. It's my favorite city in the world, and I don't even have to think about that. There are close seconds, but Venice is the first. It's honestly, I really appreciate this.
I want to thank everybody for listening and also wish you all a happy Thanksgiving if you're here in the United States. I want to thank John Adams for producing this episode, and I want to thank Luca Marzotto for the conversation. I don't know that he's ever done anything like that, so I hope you enjoyed. Do not forget to watch the new documentary special on the Santa Margarita family, the Marzotto family, on SOM TV right now. If you're not a subscriber, go to SOMTV.com and do that. And get your tickets for Cup of Salvation. Go to SOMFilms.com to grab your tickets for Boston, New York City, and Vancouver. All right, everybody, drink something nice and be nice to your family, okay?